Well, good afternoon, everyone. There's a few more seats available here near the front if you haven't found a seat where you're standing right now. Welcome to our afternoon session on Farm to Fork Politics, an insider's view of the look ahead for food and agriculture in 2013. My name is Sarah Wyant. I'm editor and publisher of AgriPulse Communications, and I'm delighted to see so many of you here this afternoon. I'd also like to personally thank our partners in crime, so to speak, for organizing this event to celebrate Ag Day. And those are the folks at the Ag Council of America who have worked tirelessly to make sure that everyone is informed about the great contributions of agriculture and who have helped us partner on this event as well as our reception this evening that will immediately follow our panel discussion and a host of activities tomorrow. And I'd like Jenny Pickett, who organizes that, as well as Barry Nelson, to stand up and be recognized. Now, one of the best things about our panel this afternoon is that we have three very distinguished presenters. And I will introduce them from left to right. First is J.B. Penn, who probably needs no introduction to many of you here in Washington. J.B. is currently the chief economist for Deer & Company, and most of the time when I try to find him, he's in India or Russia or somewhere around the globe, and so I'm especially delighted that he could take time to be in Washington, D.C. today for this panel discussion. He previously worked at USDA as Undersecretary for Farm and Foreign Agricultural Services, and before that did a little gig in media with the Sparks Company, now Informa. Second on our panel will be Hudson Reilly, who is the Senior Vice President of Research and Knowledge Group for the National Restaurant Association. He is an excellent source, has authored a wide variety of articles and a lot of different videos as well that you can find on the NRA website about consumer, economic, and human resource trends in the restaurant and food service industry. So, Hudson, welcome to you as well. And last but certainly not least is Keith Collins, who served as chief economist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture from 1993 to 2008 under four different secretaries of agriculture, two Democrats, two Republicans, but he actually started his career there much earlier with Secretary John Block. And I know Secretary Block is planning to be here a little later. I don't see him right now, but he is planning to join us. So it'll bring back some more memories for Keith, who has had such a distinguished career at USDA and currently serves as a consultant on risk management issues for the National Crop Insurance Services. Now, the other terrific thing about this panel discussion is that we really want all of you to participate, and that is that we want you to listen and respond or ask questions of each of our presenters. And they maybe will ask you a couple questions as well to get some different interaction within the audience. So each of them is going to make a few brief remarks, and then we're going to open it up for questions. I'm going to be roving with a microphone, as well as Jason Lutz on our staff. We'll have another microphone, so feel free to raise your hand, and we'll get the dialogue going on these very pressing issues for food and agriculture. And I have to say the other thing that I'm really excited about for this discussion this afternoon is that as a reporter, I go to a lot of different meetings and press conferences, and usually it's all about having one agenda where the information is very much in line with who the presenters have lined up for that day. Well, this is unique in that we have a diverse set of backgrounds among our presenters, and it's really about the dialogue and the discussion and learning about those critical issues for 2013 in food and agriculture. So with that, I'd like to have J.B. Penn kick off and make his initial comments. So, J.B.?
Thank you, Sarah. It's a real pleasure to be with you this afternoon, and it's also nice to be a part of the National Ag Day activities where we get to celebrate this great industry and to look at some of the accomplishments that we've had over the past few years. We do have a lot of critics these days, so it's nice to be in an environment where we're only saying positive things for a while. I really appreciate Sarah organizing this and getting a lot of people, especially from out of town, to come and to be part of this. I understand the session is to be forward-looking, to be sort of outlook-oriented. But before I turn to looking ahead to 2013 and some of the expectations for the business environment, I think this being National Ag Day, one of the activities that maybe we could look back a little bit and develop a little context as to how we got here today. And then I think that might give us a little bit of insight into what we could expect as we look to 2013 and beyond. Now, when we look back for 10 years or 12 years to the turn of the century, a lot of very significant things have happened to affect our industry. And one of the most important ones is that the global economic trends began shifting around the turn of the century. And that was characterized by very robust and very widespread GDP growth among the developing countries. And that led to job creation, that led to increased incomes, that led to people wanting to eat better, eat more. And so that has been a big, big driver for our industry over the past dozen years. Just consider, in 2010, we had about 7 billion people in the world, and 60% of those people lived in countries that were growing at 6% annual GDP growth or faster, and 40% of those lived in countries that were growing at 8% or faster. So those are the countries where the diets were the least adequate, but they're the ones where the biggest transformations were being made. And that has continued, not in a straight line, but it's certainly continued to this point in time. And that's been a big, big factor in fueling the growth in global agriculture and the food industry over the past dozen years. The other backdrop over the past dozen years is that population growth has continued apace, and the growth is fastest, as we know, in the developing countries where the diets are the least adequate. So we've had those two big factors. And then we've had increased urbanization. More and more people are leaving the rural areas, moving to the cities, relying on someone else to grow and present their food. In 2007, we passed the halfway point. More than 50% of the world's population lived in urban areas in 2007. And the projections are that by 2050, that will be 70%. So we are sort of coagulating into great population centers with some pretty sparse rural areas. Now, that's the demand side. And that's been, as I said, a big, big factor in our story over the past dozen years. On the supply side, we've seen the global ag production plant really struggle to keep pace at times. I looked at the numbers recently, and grain consumption has increased steadily year over year, every year since 1996, without fail. Every year, grain consumption has grown up. Well, the output from the global ag plant has not been as persistent, and so we've had periods in which we had adverse weather, we've had shortfalls, we've had price spikes, but we've also seen that comes about from neglect of agriculture in a lot of developing countries for decades. No investment in research and development, no investment in infrastructure, and very little attention to policies that would encourage investment and development. And in contrast, when we look at developed country agriculture and certainly U.S. agriculture, we've made a lot of investment in human capital, in research and development, in infrastructure and technology of all kinds. And we've seen our productivity growth accelerate. It's been amazing. You look at corn yields or soybean yields or livestock output, and we've made some tremendous advances over the past dozen years. Well, the result of the demand side, the supply side, and weather being erratic has been that we've seen prices that have been well above long-term trends. We've seen a period of unsurpassed prosperity for developed country agriculture, and that's certainly the case for U.S. agriculture, where we've had record farm incomes. We have the strongest balance sheet in the history of agriculture. But we've also seen more market volatility and more uncertainty from year to year, and we continue to see that. Now, this economic environment, which has been one with exceptional prices and more uncertainty and volatility, has also brought some other changes over the past dozen years in the global food and ag system. We've got new market participants that are becoming very, very important. China comes to mind, first of all. China used to be a big player in the wheat market, took a conscious decision about the turn of the century to go out of the wheat market, but instead decided to be an importer of soybeans. It accounts now for two-thirds of all of the soybean imports in the world go to China. It imports about the same amount that Brazil produces. It's one of the largest importers of cotton. And the big question on a lot of people's minds is, what about corn? Is it next? What will China do for corn? And some of the forecasts, like from the U.S. Grains Council, are 30 million tons by 2020, up from just a few million tons this year. So that's a big question. And then the rise of Latin America has been something new in the past dozen years or so. Brazil now is the number three exporter in the world in terms of sales after the U.S. and the European Union. But it's also number one in soybeans, number one in beef, sugar, coffee, ethanol, and frozen chickens. So that part of the world is now playing a much bigger role in the global ag scene than formerly. And then the Black Sea region, notably the former Soviet Union, Russia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan. Production after about 2000 began to stabilize. They have now begun to enter the foreign markets in quite a big way. And so they're becoming a big, big factor in the global grain markets. And overall, we're seeing that the traditional exporters are seeing a decline in their market share, while these non-traditional exporters are increasing their market share. And we have more competitors that are entering the market, especially the corn market. Some are relatively small, but more and more are now providing product to the global markets. And in fact, the U.S. Share of the global grain market, which was above 40% in 1990, has fallen to 25% today. So despite increased sales, the volume has actually gone down. So all of this is causing some new issues to emerge, and one of them is regional competitiveness. In North America, we're seeing higher land prices and decaying infrastructure, which is reducing our competitiveness. And in Latin America and the Black Sea region, we're seeing farmers adopt more on-farm technology, which reduces their unit cost, and we're also seeing more and more investment in infrastructure, which enables them to be more competitive in the global markets. And I note that agricultural and food trade is once again on the policy agenda, and I think it's becoming clearer and clearer as we look ahead to 2050 that we've got increasing urbanization. As I mentioned, we have a few regions of the world that are food surplus producers. We're going to have to move the food from where it's produced to where it's consumed. So trade is going to become even more important. We need to give more attention to market access, sanitary and phytosanitary standards, border and customs measures, all of those things. So while the Doha negotiations languish, the possibility of a U.S. European Union Free Trade Agreement, the possibility of TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, have brought new energy to the trade space. And so I think this is extremely important to U.S. agriculture as we look to trying to capitalize on growth in some of these foreign markets. And now to 2013, to turn to the outlook. On the demand side, 2013 is going to be better than 2012. The macro environment is going to be more robust, going to be stronger than it was in 2012. So that means that's a very positive thing for food growth, food demand growth. The International Monetary Fund says we'll grow at 3.5% globally this year. So That could be even stronger if the U.S. economy should surprise us and get a little more traction if the Europeans come back a little faster than expected. Then on the supply side, outlook is very weather dependent at this point. The prospects are very good for a large Latin American harvest. We're seeing the harvest now well underway. The weather has been good, so the harvest is going to be large. So the attention now is focused very much on North America and very specifically on the planting season. Now, there are lots of forecasts for acreage. How much will farmers plant to corn and how much to soybeans? And we've all seen those. But it's weather now that is going to be the key. We're worried about the effects of persistent drought. Will we have adequate moisture? So we've got a wider range of possibilities. Dr. Collins used to do the outlook, and he always had it into a very compact, narrow space. But this year, we can be over here or we can be over here, and it depends on the weather. If we have really favorable weather, given the acreage that farmers say they'll plant to corn and soybeans and other crops, we'll have large harvest, we'll have trend yields, we'll have stocks that build a little bit, and we'll have softening prices. If, on the other hand, we have another poor weather year in North America, then we'll have below-trend yield, short crops, and we'll have much stronger prices once again. But regardless of how 2013 turns out, and we should know in the next 30 to 60 days in terms of the planting weather, we still have agriculture, the industry still has these strong tailwinds. We have population growth and incomes growth, and this growth is not going to be in a straight line. We're going to have deviations from year to year, but over the long term, we still have those major tailwinds, and they're going to serve this industry well. So I'm going to end on a very positive note. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the National Restaurant Association's Research and Knowledge Group, it is a pleasure to have a couple minutes to talk with you today about the current state of the restaurant industry, but most importantly, where we see it heading this year and beyond. When you think about the restaurant industry this year, total industry sales will reach a record high despite a host of challenges. The industry will post sales of $660 billion this year. That's up 3.8% over last year. And in inflation-adjusted terms, that's a 0.8% real increase. 2013 is the fourth consecutive year of sales growth for the restaurant industry. The period of 2008-2009 was the weakest period for the restaurant industry in its recent history. So the environment has improved as the general underlying economic conditions have improved. But the size and scope of the restaurant industry only continues to get larger. If you think about that $660 billion, if the restaurant industry was actually a country in the global economy, it would rank number 19 out of almost 170 countries. So it has become an economic juggernaut, and it used to be 20 years ago we'd say what happened to the general economy happened to the restaurant industry, but it is now an environment whereby what happens to the restaurant industry actually impacts our nation's macroeconomic conditions. If you look at that $660 billion, it is spread across 70 distinct segments. So when one asks how the restaurant industry is doing, it's really a compilation of each of those individual segments. Now, some of those segments are obviously quite large. The largest would be table service, which is a $208 billion market this year, followed by the quick service, which is a $188 billion market. But each of those segments has different operating characteristics. It has different patronage demographics. And when one looks at the future of the restaurant industry this year and beyond, a key component is demographics and what goes on with personal income growth. If there's one macroeconomic indicator that correlates well with growth in the restaurant industry, It is what goes on with real disposable personal income. Because for all intents and purposes, restaurant spending is what we call a cash or credit on hand situation from the consumer. And if the consumer is confident and employment is better, it means that they tend to spend more at restaurants. And if you look at total food spending in America today, 48%, almost half, is currently allocated towards the restaurant community. And if you go back as far back as we track it as 1955, and at that point, just 25%, or one out of every $4 spent on food, was spent in the restaurant industry. So you can see as the decades have progressed, consumers have gradually shifted their spending towards the away-from-home market. Now, the interesting thing is we tend to think of restaurant spending in an even larger context. And if you look at how consumers today spend their money overall, half of all consumer spending is related to housing and transportation. Food accounts for about 13% of all spending in America today, and roughly half of that is away from home. But the restaurant industry has been very successful at basically taking a larger share of a smaller share of the consumer expenditure pie. So it is interesting, if you go back 10, 20, 30 years, spending on food actually was a substantially larger proportion of consumer expenditures. Now, Americans now are much more interested in food than at any previous point. If you think about how the typical restaurant patron is much more educated and has a much more sophisticated palate now than at any point in time. And what that means from a restaurant operator perspective is that the food that is served, from a consumer perspective, they are much more interested in knowing the story behind that food. For example, how it is sourced, how it is prepared. And because restaurants are a consumer-driven industry, the operator community has obviously responded to this. For example, each year we do a chef survey among 1,800 chefs across the country, and we give them a list of 200 food and beverage items. And if you look at the top five items out of that list of 200-plus, the top five have two very important threads among them. And one is sourcing, and the other is children's cuisine. And when you look at how Americans use restaurants in their daily lifestyle, I mean, Americans love going to restaurants. Over 90% enjoy going to restaurants. And you know you can't get 90% of Americans to agree on anything, but they do enjoy going to restaurants. And so when one looks ahead towards the future of the evolution of the restaurant industry, because that share, that 48% of all spending, will continue to move ahead. The question is just how that proportion quickly moves ahead. And from a consumer perspective now, if an interesting statistic, which isn't well known, is that if you look at all restaurant traffic in America today, 70% of that traffic is what in the industry we call off-premises, which is takeout, delivery, drive-through, curbside, and mobile. So in terms of looking how consumers will continue to use restaurants, you see a greater emphasis now on points of access. There are almost 1 million restaurant locations in America today, and that number in general advances about 1% a year. And from a restaurant operator perspective, it's also important to keep in mind how substantial variations in local economic conditions directly translate into the rate of growth of restaurant sales. And so, for example, if you look at the highest growth rates in restaurant sales at the moment, it tends to be in the West-South Central region, for example, Texas, energy states such as North Dakota. And if one really wants to chart the future of restaurant sales, one closely looks at the local economic conditions, because ultimately job growth is a very, very important determinant of how restaurant sales proceed. And we know it's job growth is related to consumer confidence, but when people are employed, they have a heightened demand for convenience, and they have higher incomes, and there's always been a very strong correlation between growth in incomes and growth in restaurant spending. So when you look at the restaurant industry this year, the 3.8% increase is positive. It's not as strong growth rates as prior to 2008, but it is still positive. There is substantial pent-up demand for restaurants. About one out of every three Americans reports they're not using restaurants as much as they would like in their daily lifestyle. So looking ahead towards this year and beyond, the industry employs now over 13 million individuals. One out of every 10 individuals working in America actually works in the restaurant industry. One out of three, it's their first job. One out of two has actually worked in the restaurant industry at some point in their lives. So this year, positive growth, and looking ahead over the next decade, when one looks at the macroeconomic indicators on an average basis, that growth will continue. Although the growth rates are not what they're going to be as they were 40 years ago. If you look at the restaurant industry over the past four decades plus, the compound annual growth rate was 6.6%, and that's a respectable growth rate and has sizable real growth in that. But over the past decade, real growth in the restaurant industry has just averaged on a CAGR basis just 4.2%. So you can see that there has been that moderation. And when we look ahead over the next decade, it is definitely a moderate growth environment, positive, but not at the growth rates over the past decade. So that's fine for me for a moment. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I, too, would like to start by thanking Sarah and AgriPulse for hosting this. This is quite an accomplishment, a great contribution to Ag Day, Sarah. Thank you. And I thank you for inviting me to be on this panel. In thinking about Ag Day, of course, it's a time to celebrate and promote and recognize American agriculture. And I was thinking about the growth of American agriculture over my lifetime. In my lifetime, the gross value of farm income has gone from $30 billion to this year expected to be $480 billion in my lifetime. I'm an old guy, right? That's a 16-fold increase. It's now $500 billion in gross farm income. And along with that growth and what has supported that growth has been tremendous advances in technology, seed technology, equipment. Along with that has come a healthier, a more diverse, and a safer food supply. Along with that has come products in addition to food, like energy and biofuels. And so you have to step back and say that this is a series of accomplishments we'd like to see people outside of this room understand and recognize. And so I add my congratulations to agriculture and Ag Day, too. Okay, Sarah, you gave us a charge to say something prophetic about 2013. When thinking about that, I recalled that John Kenneth Galbraith once said about economists who forecast, they fall into two classes of economists. One, those who don't know, and two, those who don't know they don't know. So at USDA, as JB said, I used to be I had the general responsibility for commodity market forecasting. And we sort of looked at that a different way. We used to say, if there was a 50-50 chance we're going to be wrong, then 9 out of 10 times we will be. I'm not going to say anything specific about 2013, but there are three areas that are on my mind, and so I'll just share those as things that I'm watching for in 2013, and it's the macroeconomic environment that we live in, and it's the corn market, And then it's risk management. And so just a couple of points about each of those. On the macroeconomic environment, you did trigger my memory, Sarah, when you mentioned Secretary Block. The first real farm bill I ever worked on in any meaningful way was the 1985 farm bill, when I had the great fortune of being assigned to work on Secretary Block's farm bill task force, which Randy Russell chaired. And I remember I learned a lesson back in that period. And Secretary Block was on a crusade to have people in agriculture understand the importance of macroeconomic variables to production agriculture. And things like exchange rates, inflation, interest rates, all that stuff. And if you look back at 1985, the value of the dollar in 1985 compared to today it's 50% of what it was in 1985. We had a huge overvaluation of the dollar back then, which hurt our exports. We had double-digit interest rates, which just created a farm financial crisis in the 1980s. So I have been paying attention to macroeconomics and its effect on agriculture from those lessons of the 1980s. And as an economist, you think about three words, really, when you think about macroeconomics. You think about liquidity, solvency, and growth. And on the liquidity issue, we've got a Federal Reserve that is buying $85 billion of Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities every month. At some point, they're going to start to disengage from that. And that can have some important implications for interest rates and exchange rates, for farmers' costs of production, for the competitiveness of our products in world markets. And so I'm watching very closely to see when we get to that point where we begin to slow down the liquidity growth that we've had since the recession. The second area on solvency, of course, solvency refers to the debt and deficit problems we have. And you're probably familiar with the work that economists have done, and a number of them have done this work, looking at what happens when the national debt, the debt held by the public as a percent of gross domestic product, gets too high. And if that gets too high and two other things happen, your economic growth is slow and you run a large current account deficit, and all three of those things apply to us right now, then bad things happen to your economy over time. And so addressing solvency is a critical challenge for Congress. It's to put the deficit on a sustainable path. And to address liquidity, manage liquidity well, and deal with solvency feeds into economic growth. And Hudson was talking about the effect of economic growth on restaurant sales. If you look at our economic growth, it's not been that strong. It's been running 2-2.5%. Much below what it was in the mid-2000s. Personal consumption spending is much below what it was in the mid-2000s. And I'm hoping that in 2013, we're going to manage our liquidity issue, we're going to do something with our solvency issue, and we're going to help fortify our economic growth, and it will improve and start to get better. The second area I mentioned was corn. And why not corn? You know, it's called King Corn, and for a good reason. It accounts for about one-third of the acreage in the United States. I noticed that the current forecasts out of USDA say that corn cash receipts this year will be $96 billion, 44% of all the receipts for crops in the United States. So that when corn inhales everything around it, you know, there's waves, there's wakes that occur. It affects all the other major field crops. It affects the acreage planted and affects their prices. So corn is on my mind. And a lot of forecasters are expecting a bumper crop in 2013. And that would provide welcome relief to users of corn, from the bioenergy industry to the livestock industry, who have faced very high corn prices this past year. $7.20 a bushel for the 2012 crop is the expected farm price. And these forecasts for a bumper crop are suggesting that corn prices could go down quite a bit. USDA says by harvest into the low $4. And JB talked about whether that might or might not happen. When I look at this, I think that it seems likely that we'll do better in corn production in 2013 than we did in 2012. In 2012, by my measure, the yield that we had in corn was 24% below the trend yield in corn for 2012. And that means that that was the largest drop below trend in 25 years caused by a drought. So 2012 was a 1 in 25-year event. So as a statistician, you would say, well, you know, 1 in 25-year events don't happen every year. So we should have a resumption of normal production or closer to it in 2013. And if we get that, then we'll see a rebuilding of stocks. We'll see lower prices. We'll see relief provided to the users of corn and some rebounding, hopefully, in our export share that has fallen off the table so dramatically this past year. But there is a big risk, and the risk is this, that right now the forecast for corn stocks next September at the end of the 2012-2013 year is for only 5.6% of use. That would be the second lowest in the last 50 years. I only went back to 1960. I didn't have data before that, but there's only twice that's happened in 50 years. So that means that we don't have a lot of cushion. So we really need to have a more normal production this coming year. So I'm watching the weather developments, and I'm watching what might happen with corn. The last point I wanted to mention builds on that, the risk that we face of having a short crop. I want to talk about risk management. Since Sarah did mention I do now work for the crop insurance industry, it shouldn't come as a surprise that I'm going to say something about risk management. And I believe in 2013 we will see this continuing evolution toward a greater reliance on crop insurance in our farm safety net. The solvency problem we have means that agriculture is going to face spending constraints for years to come. And I think American agriculture knows that, the farm sector knows that, and they have been prioritizing their programs within the farm safety net, and they've said, we want to keep crop insurance, and so far Congress has fought along and cut other programs, but not the crop insurance program. And I think the reason for that is you only have to look at what's happened the last couple of years across the United States. 2011, a tremendous drought in the southern plains. 2012, a tremendous drought in the Midwest. In addition to that, we had floods in 2011. We had floods and hurricane damage up the eastern seaboard last year. And so what crop insurance has done is it has prevented lots of tremendous farm stress that would have occurred in states like Texas and Oklahoma and Illinois and Indiana, Missouri, Kentucky, Virginia, even all the way up to Vermont, up the eastern seaboard. And as a result of that, farmers are paying their bills. They're paying their John Deere dealerships bills. They're paying their bankers off. They're fortifying the rural community they live in because of the program and the support that it has provided. So I think that just what crop insurance has done is what's motivating the support for it. But it doesn't come without a cost. And you probably see the stories in the press that a lot of money is being paid out in indemnities this year. Those numbers are updated every Monday. Today's number is $15.9 billion has been paid out as a result of the 2012 production losses to date. It's important to recognize that's not the cost of the crop insurance program. That's indemnities paid. From that, you have to subtract the premiums that farmers pay, and you have to subtract this year the unusual situation of the crop insurance companies losing money. So they're paying part of the bill this year. The crop insurance companies will have a double-digit negative rate of return this year on the 2012 crop year. Now, one of the reasons that the program cost has gone up is because the insured liability has gone up. In the last 10 years, the insured liability has gone from $37 billion, this is the value of what's insured, $37 billion to this year, $117 billion. That's a tremendous increase, and it reflects more than a doubling of commodity market prices over the past decade. It reflects a big increase in participation. in the program, and it reflects farmers buying up to higher levels of coverage. And all three of those things have worked together to drive that liability. In the end, I think I'll go back to my earlier point that I look in 2013 for a smaller farm safety net for American agriculture, but one that cements the position of crop insurance in the future. Thank you.
Well, special thanks to each of you for some great thought-provoking comments about agriculture and the restaurant food service industry. We'd like to open it up now to questions from anyone in the audience. Jason, raise your hand there. Jason has a microphone. If you want to raise your hand, and Jason will come over to you, or I will run over with this microphone and have you ask some of your questions. Before I ask the first one, I want to see if any of the panelists had questions for each other as a result of some of the comments that you made.
That would be a mortal sin for one panelist to ask the other a question, wouldn't it? I said mortal sin only because we just got a pope recently. That's why I was.
Well, let me ask the first one about a question, and Betsy will come to you, about one of the topics that's become almost a dirty word here in Washington, and that is sequestration, and the impact that that's going to have on the economy. There's a lot of gloom and doom stories about the negative impact, not only on paychecks in the Washington community as people might get furloughed, but at the same time, we've seen the stock market that's going great guns right now. What's the market really telling us? I mean, is sequestration going to really have a long-term negative impact on the economy, or is it good news because it's a way that we're going to address federal spending issues in a political fashion that no one perhaps had anticipated when it was first planned?
I'll take a shot at that. I think you actually partially answered the question. It's both good news and bad news. The bad news, I guess, would be to look at the studies, the economic studies that have been done of what sequestration means for gross domestic product and employment. And probably the one that's gotten most public attention has been the Congressional Budget Office study, which said that in this year, 2013, that gross domestic product would be about 0.5%, 0.6% lower than it would otherwise be, and that if we didn't have the sequester, there'd be about 750,000 more jobs in the economy. Okay, so that's a one-year short-term impact. You mentioned the stock market reaction to that. That, to me, is the good news about the sequester. We are doing something about our solvency problem with it. You might not like what we're doing, but we are doing something. I mean, it's been very easy to excoriate Congress for partisanship and the American public, for that matter, for partisanship and the gridlock that results, but there's been a sequence of things that have occurred, from a little revenue rising in the Taxpayer Relief Act to budget cutting in the Budget Control Act of 2011 to the sequester. And so I think that Wall Street looks upon that positively, that is helping to get the solvency house in order and moving us away from this edge that I talked about, where many economists worry about what a high public debt means to the future growth of the economy.
Sure. I mean, to tag on to what Keith was saying, basically, if you look at it on a macroeconomic level from the consumer perspective, in certain geographic areas, obviously, there are going to be consumers that have less cash on hand, and the relationship, as I mentioned earlier, between restaurant spending and cash on hand and employment has always been well linked. But it's important to understand this in a greater context, too, in that, for example, if you look at the sequestration effects and the states where they have disproportionate effects, in all likelihood going forward in the short term, it will dampen restaurant industry sales growth. It's important to look at this in the context of other conditions that are occurring too. So, for example, if you look at restaurant industry sales on a monthly basis, December was the highest month, and January and February, according to the monthly census of retail trade, although it is still at a high level and hasn't fallen off the cliff, both January and February were declines. And so when you take the sequestration in tandem with the 2% FICA tax that is now back, and then you look at what's going on with retail gasoline prices, because the industry has found, not surprisingly, that when retail gas prices escalate and remain at a sustained level, it does dampen restaurant industry spending growth again. And so then you also, too, look at the first quarter weather conditions compared to the first quarter of 2012. And obviously that was a milder weather environment, and this quarter is obviously harsher. And the association has done research regarding weather conditions that are beneficial to restaurant industry sales growth. And in general, restaurant industry sales growth tends to be higher when winter conditions are milder than expected and summer conditions are cooler than expected. So the marvelous thing about the restaurant industry is it's so complex and multifaceted that it is developments in different arenas can have immediate impacts on what goes on with restaurant sales. And there's a lot of externalities that go on. And so to reiterate what I said earlier, it is a positive environment this year, but the growth rates compared to historical performance, it's definitely much more modest.
That one's been about beat to death, so let's have your question.
Betsy Freeze, Successful Farming. If you had to pick one day this spring that would be the tipping point for you on what this year is going to look like for the crop season, what day would that be?
The end of July.
So you wouldn't pick anything
this
spring?
Look at what happened last year. You remember we were going along, you know, doing really well, had great expectations, and about the first week in June we started hearing the drought word, drought. That was about the first time, and then two or three days later prices started to move higher, and then we saw what happened to the crop. Look, we can have a perfect spring. We can get the crop in. We can go until early June. We can lose it then. You can go to early July, whenever pollination is, you can lose it then. So it's not until the crop is made that you can really say that that we've got it almost in the bin.
Thanks, Betsy.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Ted McKinney, Alanco. I think it was Sarah that mentioned this possible trade opportunity with Europe, and I'm just curious what your crystal ball tells you with that. Given the incredible differences, even the word polarization comes to mind as a better description between our policies. Anything you can project?
Well, I'll start, and we can go back up that way. I've been involved in trade negotiations, been involved in some negotiations with the Europeans, and it's not a fun thing to do. When you're dealing with people who invoke the precautionary principle, who refuse to accept other widely accepted scientific measures, you just got tired of beating your head against the wall. So when I first heard about the possibility of a U.S.-EU trade agreement and one that could well include agriculture, I was very skeptical. But the more that I have learned about that, the more I have moved away from that position. Because I think the world has changed. Circumstances have changed. I am now, from the information that I get, becoming convinced that the Europeans are sincere, that they see their economy needs a jump start. They see the problems that they've got with austerity and with the financial crisis, and that they're beginning to show some signs of good faith. So I'm not naive about this, but I'm much more optimistic than I was a couple of months ago. I think this could be a possibility to do something that would be just enormous for agriculture, both here and in the European Union. And since the Doha talks have stalled, languished, it seems to me that this could be something that really reinvigorates the trade negotiations in a much bigger sphere. And if the two largest economies in the world could agree to a robust free trade agreement, a lot of other people are going to want to sign on. So you might be able to do in large part with a regional agreement like this what you couldn't do with the Doha agreement. So I have moved a bit, Ted. I've come around to where I think we ought to explore it to the fullest, and then if it doesn't work, we haven't lost much.
You know, I could call that a triumph of hope over experience, but I won't. I think that was a good analysis by JB, but I guess I'm a little more skeptical. First of all, I don't know anything about the European proposal. All I know is I read the working paper that was produced for the heads of state that was used as a basis for President Obama's decision, or part of the basis for his decision, and it's pretty vague. But if in fact, as JB suggests, that can be accomplished and become a stepping stone to a broader multilateral trade negotiation successful process, that would be terrific. But that's exactly what was said about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And that's ongoing. And that's a heck of a lot further along than negotiations with Europe, but yet they're far from being completed. I think as we sit here and speak, we're in the 16th round of the TPP negotiations right now. But the good thing is, and it provides evidence for one of the things JB said, and that is that Japan wants to join the TPP, become, I guess, the 12th country. And why? It's because, for the same reason the European Union is looking for trade liberalization, to help jumpstart their economy, too. That's one of the three platforms that the Japanese Prime Minister utilized when he talked about promoting growth in the Japanese economy. So I have hopes for both of these agreements, but having seen what happened in Doha and in understanding how countries, how difficult it is to overcome special interests, if it's broad, if it's comprehensive, and it does like what the TPP is supposed to do, which is to eliminate tariffs and non-tariff barriers, that would be great. But it may be something that looks a lot different than that when all is said and done.
I won't talk specifically about the negotiations, but I will make a couple of points that are of importance to the industry regarding international aspects. Basically, America is the world leader in restaurant services, and that knowledge and expertise is a very important component of growth for many international restaurant operators now. And as a result of decade after decade of honing the restaurant delivery system, that expertise now is readily being sought after by different governments as well as operators in foreign countries. And it's also important from the restaurant industry perspective to understand the role of international tourism in the development of restaurant market and restaurant sales growth. When you look at all restaurant sales in America today, roughly about one out of every four sales dollars is travel and tourism related. And if you look at what's gone on with international visitation to the United States now, international spending is at a record high, and the visitation finally has reached another record high too. And from a restaurant operator perspective, that's very important because where these international visitors go and spend ends up bolstering and generating incremental restaurant sales. And so, for example, if you take, say, the South American, Central American economies now, A lot of those visitors tend to go to the mountain states, Colorado, for example. A lot of the Asian visitors go to the West Coast states. And so it's an entirely different situation if one is a, say, a fine dining restaurant operator located in Miami than if one is a quick service restaurant operator located on an interstate highway. But what the industry has learned, and 9/11 was a very pivotal point in that aspect, is that the role of travel and tourism in the maintenance and development of restaurant sales is quite important.
Hi. Can you see me? I'm a little short. my name is Victoria Gao, and I'm from Department of Commerce. I work on food security. And I think it was Dr. Penn who raised the increased agriculture outputs of Latin America and their increased global market access. I was wondering if you guys can comment on the political implications of that, if there are any, or do you see this as a completely, you know, more of a stabilizing force when one region is subject to drought, you know, we have another hemisphere that can, you know, stabilize the market. So do you see any threats and or is it just complete benefits?
Well, let me start, and I'm sure that Keith can elaborate on this a bit. There are many aspects that you could address to that question. Let me do just one. First of all, we all know about the challenge of feeding the world. We're going from 7.5 billion people to 9.5 billion people by 2050. So we're going to have to produce a lot more food, and we're going to have to do it everywhere in the world. I mean, it's got to be done not only in the food surplus regions now, like Latin America and North America and the Black Sea region and maybe the EU, but it's going to have to be done in the developing world. It's going to have to be where it's consumed. Very, very little food of the total produced today is actually traded, a relatively small proportion. Most of the food that is consumed is consumed in the same place that it's produced, the same country, never crosses a national boundary. But that's going to change. I mean, and the proportion that is required by trade will increase. So we're going to have to see everybody contribute if we're going to feed the world and if we're going to feed it better than we're doing today even. So that's one aspect. The other concerns, I think the trade aspects, I mentioned in my opening remarks a little bit about regional competitiveness. I think that's going to be an issue that becomes a pretty big one in the next few years as we begin to look at who can not only produce a ton of grain and bring it to the farm gate at the lowest price, but who can take that ton of grain or soybeans and put it in an export location at a very competitive price. And I think that, as I mentioned, is going to require some real soul searching about where we make our investments in North America and where others make investments in infrastructure and things of that nature. But one thing I have noticed in the data, one implication of relying more on other regions of the world to produce the food is that other regions are more volatile than the traditional exporting regions of Europe and North America. That is, the weather is more variable, first of all, and so you're more likely to have a production shortfall. And the on-farm technology is not yet as good in these new regions as it is in the traditional regions of North America and Europe. They don't have all of the great John Deere equipment that they need, so when the weather is ideal, they can plant the crop within a week, or when the weather is ideal, they can harvest the crop in a week, and you don't lose lots of it. So they've not yet adopted all of the on-farm technology. Genetics is another factor. And then infrastructure. Now, that's another one. They simply don't have the infrastructure. They still have more post-harvest losses. And the other is policies. I mean, you know, we went through some bad policies in the late 70s, some export embargoes and some things of that nature. And we've learned, but a lot of other countries are still learning those lessons. And so you tend to see more bad policies that tend to disrupt production, disrupt exports. We saw that just the past couple of years when we had a price spike. We had export embargoes from some traditionally exporting countries. So you add those things together, and I think those regions are just more volatile than North America and Europe, but we're relying more and more on them. So that means prices are likely to be more volatile as we see a more frequent production shortfall. So I can see that we'd have more market volatility. That would be one implication of that.
The only thing I could probably add to that, you said a lot of things there. The issue about volatility I found interesting. A couple of years ago, somebody did a study looking at, among all the grain producers of the world, what kind of disruptions they had in production and how frequently they occurred. And I was amazed to see that almost every year, some grain producer in the world was having a drought or a flood or something that was disturbing their production. But I think when we look out to the future in this challenge of feeding a 9 billion population world, the so-called 70% increase in food needs from here to 2050, everybody realizes that most of that's got to come from yield and not acreage. And they focus on a couple of geographic regions where that's going to come from, Latin America being one, for example, because of the big interior region in Brazil, and then the Black Sea countries being another. And it's clearly true that the weather variability and yield variability in the Black Sea countries is a lot greater. The other part of this, though, in feeding more people in the future is not just to focus on those major exporters, but to focus on regions where production is really lacking, like sub-Saharan Africa, for example. The UN has done an awful lot of work on this issue of feeding 9 billion people. And among the work that they've done is they've looked at the research that countries have engaged in to improve their technology, their production capacity. And I was surprised to see, and this is a paper that UN sponsored last year, the period of time that the paper looked at was about a 10 or 15-year period. And research spending in nominal dollars in sub-Saharan Africa on food and agriculture actually went down. And so there's a real challenge here. You mentioned the political process and you mentioned governance, JB. There's a real challenge here for countries that are going to need food, that are going to be importers, to develop the right policies, develop the market institutions, develop the infrastructure that allows the price signals to get to their farmers so that they can meet this challenge in the future.
And I'll just tag on from a, once again, restaurant operator perspective, this sustainability and social responsibility arena from the consumer perspective is really much more top of mind than it was a decade or so ago. And from the consumer perspective, the ability of a restaurant operator to differentiate themselves from the competition in terms of communication with the consumer about their sustainability and social responsibility initiatives is very important, particularly among younger consumers. And so if you think about how you find out about which restaurant to go to, word of mouth has always been the most important referral of restaurant patronage, and that is still true today, but the paradigm has shifted about how that word of mouth occurs. It is now through social media to a great extent. And as we tell restaurant operators, when there is a table full of patrons there, they might as well envision having a desktop computer there, because with the smartphone capacity and the ability to communicate to consumers the story of their food and the sourcing becomes a very important marketing and promotional component. And so what you see now in the restaurant operator community is a much stronger alliance of the supplier community working with operators to communicate through social media and other promotional mechanisms about that menu and where it's sourced and how it's prepared.
Andrew Bowman, I'm a farmer from Western Illinois. We also utilize and sell some crop insurance. So I'd like to direct my question to Dr. Penn and Dr. Collins. What should producers, commodity groups, and agribusiness be doing to protect crop insurance, and how should they be positioning themselves in 2013? And in particular, I'd like your thoughts from a global perspective. You've talked a little bit about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the potential EU deal. Those are countries that would like to probably label crop insurance subsidies as amber box payments rather than blue or green. If this is going to be the new way that we have a safety net for rural America, it'd be nice to have a long-term assurances that it's not going to create another cotton case where we're paying other countries off for our premium subsidies. So please comment.
Well, I can start. there's a couple of questions there. Maybe dealing with the latter one first is easier because I can remember that one. First of all, crop insurance is not a green box or a blue box program under under the UN classification system. It is an amber box program. It is production and trade distorting. The United States government notifies it as production and trade distorting. But it has been, up until recent years, a fairly small program and hasn't gotten that much attention in world circles as a production and trade distorting program because our other farm programs were much bigger. And because crop insurance generally through research has been demonstrated to be, have a fairly minimal effect on production decisions. There's been a lot of studies that have been done. Yes, crop insurance subsidies do increase acreage, but the effect has been very, very small compared with other farm program instruments. And so foreign countries have not focused on it. In fact, in the Brazilian case, the panel determined that crop insurance was not production distorting, and it was not something that the Brazilians could countervailing duties on us because of crop insurance. But that could change. You know, it's becoming a bigger program. More money is being spent. And there's nothing to say that somewhere down the line some country doesn't challenge us. And certainly I know for a fact that foreign countries are asking more and more questions about our crop insurance program. They're asking the federal government, USDA, USTR, about the crop insurance program. So it could become more of an issue in the future. But remember, this is a program where farmers are paying a premium, and this is a program where, on average, they have a 20 or 25% deductible, so you got to take a pretty healthy loss before you get anything, and you may not get anything at all if you have a reasonable crop. The first part of your question was, what could people do to protect the program? Well, gee, you know, I think that the farm community has been pretty successful in doing that. Farmers working through their farm organizations, whether it's the American Soybean Association, corn growers, wheat growers, Cotton Council, all of them have come out in support. I'm not going to tell you how to lobby or how to advocate. It's just that I think you have to make, you as an individual, as a citizen, have to make your views and preferences known to your members of Congress. They're the ones that decide where these programs go in the future.
And I'll just briefly talk about, in terms of a restaurant operator, how they deal with food cost. If you look at a typical restaurant industry sales dollar, about one-third of that is allocated towards direct purchases of food. So consequently, what goes on in the commodities and the wholesale food price situation has a direct correlation to what goes on with their margins. And so, for example, if you look at this year, we're forecasting menu price inflation of 2.8%. We're forecasting wholesale food price inflation of around 4%. And history has demonstrated quite vividly that consumers are extremely, extremely sensitive to menu price increases, and operators are very deliberative about putting in menu price increases. So, for example, if you look at the history of wholesale food price inflation over the past 5 years, back in 2011, it was in excess of 8%, the highest rate in over 30 years. And so restaurant operators now are much more cognizant of managing food cost just because of how that ultimately translates into their income statements. And when we survey restaurant operators monthly, food cost for the past several years has always been in the top three challenges. So it is a very, very important issue to our operators on a daily basis. And the ability to educate the operator community about what is going on in these markets and not only the short-term implications but also the long-term implications is quite important.
I don't know that I can add much to what they've said, but I would say that one of the criticisms of U.S. farm policy for a long time is that it's been crafted like driving a car by looking in the rearview mirror, that we're always going from the experiences that we've had rather than what we expect to experience in the future. And I think part of the thrust of my remarks is that after about 2000, the world has changed for global agriculture and U.S. agriculture, and I think we are in a new place. And as I said, the trend is not going to every year be onward and upward. We're going to have some deviations around that. But it seems that maybe what we should be thinking about in crafting a farm policy for the future is trying to determine what we expect the environment to be. And from everything we've heard here today, it's likely to be more volatile, maybe more uncertain. So risk management becomes a much more important consideration to the farmer than considerations of the past, which have been related to farm income or to some other thing. So it seems to me that the agricultural community, the agricultural industry, should be making the case that we're trying to look forward and that risk management is going to be a much bigger deal for us in a volatile world, and maybe that's where we should focus the farm policy.
Jeremy Peters with America Farmland Trust. Sort of a follow-up question to the previous question. As crop insurance is assuming a larger portion of the farm safety net, and as increased public scrutiny is paid to crop insurance, and as we're looking forward in terms of ways to make farming both more profitable, more sustainable over the long term in meeting the needs of feeding a growing population. Some of the proposals that have been on the table for making the crop insurance program more defensible for taxpayers has included things like conservation compliance. Would appreciate your comments on that direction, and if you see that and other ways of making the program stronger in terms of justifying the federal expense for the program, and that would be the premium subsidy portion.
Okay, Mr. Crop Insurance, it's all yours.
Do I have to be known by that name? Please. Sure. I will say a few things about that. Without specifically answering your question. I obviously, as you know, that there's been concern that as we move away from income support programs, the traditional Title I programs, which have conservation compliance, highly erodible lands conservation, or wetlands compliance, tied to the receipt of benefits from those programs. As the benefits from those programs shrink, then there's a fear that farmers might walk away from highly erodible lands conservation in wetlands conservation. And so there's been proposals to look at the rising program, crop insurance, and say if you want to receive premium subsidies in crop insurance, then you should have to adhere to the conservation compliance requirements. Well, there was an amendment in the Senate Farm Bill, and that amendment passed. And so that provision is part of the Senate Farm Bill. It's not part of the House Farm Bill. But both of those farm bills have to go through the process again. The House bill never got to the floor. So I fully expect that there will be amendments for conservation compliance. There will be debate about conservation compliance. There will be votes on conservation compliance. I would say that I do work with a lot of people in the crop insurance industry. In the crop insurance industry, to the extent that they've been concerned about crop insurance or conservation compliance, it's been because they worry about their customers. That's all. It comes down to their customers. What do their customers want? Can a crop insurance company implement conservation compliance? Of course it can. You know, it can do that. And the other question they ask me about it is, you know, what are the benefits? What are the costs? And I've looked at that question, and I've concluded that the benefits are not that great and the costs are not that great. To some extent, it's a kind of a tempest in a teapot, if you don't mind me saying. And I say that because, you know, USDA did a study on how much land, how much cropland is not under conservation compliance right now. And I think it was something like 2%. And out of that 2%, they couldn't tell you how much it was highly erodible, how much it was wetland. So you bring that 2% under conservation compliance through crop insurance. That gives you some benefit, some short-term benefit, but it's not huge. Are the costs that huge? No. How many people are found out of compliance for conservation compliance? The number is tiny. I think the costs and benefits are fairly small. I think the concern and your concern at American Farmland Trust is the future. You know, where are these programs going, and will farmers walk away from the current commitment they have for highly erodible lands conservation and wetlands conservation? I don't know that they will, but there is a fear that they will, and they may. I just don't know the answer to that. I don't know of any empirical work or survey work or anything like that that's been done on that question. So I think it's a legitimate issue to raise, we'll just have to see where it goes in our political economy.
I'm Max Armstrong with This Week in Agribusiness and Farm Progress Companies, and I'd like to just come back to the topic of global market share again. Dr. Penn, you were talking about the rather impressive loss of the global grain trade since 1990. I think you said it was in excess of 40% that we had at one time, and it's gone down to about 25%. And you talked about the variables that have to fall into place there for those new developing parts of the world. But I'd like to draw on the expertise, the decades of expertise you gentlemen have at the table there. What does it look like going forward? From what you know of the landscape around the world, will we continue to lose market share? Will it be at that pace? What are the implications? And can we do just fine with the diminished market share in U.S. agriculture?
Well, let me start, Max, since you referenced me. We have a cropland base in the United States that is about, give or take, 325 million acres, and it's fully utilized, and it doesn't vary much. Despite changes in prices, despite the Conservation Reserve Program, we've got a fixed land base pretty much, and it stays fully utilized. Now, as economic conditions change, as relative prices of crops or cost of producing crops change, we shift in that land base. And, you know, after the passage of the FAIR Act in 1996, the Freedom to Farm Bill, in the couple of years after that, wheat acreage went down 10 million acres. Soybean acreage went up about 10 million acres. So we do a lot of shifts. The utilization of corn for ethanol began rapidly in 2006. We've increased corn acreage, and we've increased soybean acreage a little bit, but we've decreased the other acreages of principal crops. So the question is, how can the U.S. Continue to operate going forward and continue to utilize that cropland base in the most profitable manner? Now, you begin to look outside. If you want to grow, the growth is largely all outside the U.S. We've talked about China, the projections for Chinese corn production. consumption. Sorry, the projections for Chinese soybean consumption is something like 63 million tons this year. In 10 years' time, projected to be 95 million tons. Chinese corn, as I said, could go from 2 or 3 million tons this year, imported to 30 million tons. Corn in Mexico could go from 7 or 8 million tons imported to 19 million tons. So the growth is going to be where people are improving their diets. They're eating more livestock products. That requires more corn, more soybeans, things of that nature. Or we could go at this in a different way and start exporting more value-added products. I mean, we have seen exports of our meat and poultry products, dairy products, increase in the past few years pretty substantially. So there are different ways to look at this. But one of the points that I was trying to make in my remarks is that the economics is constantly changing. And we hear a lot about our infrastructure, our port facilities and our locks and dams and the depth of the water and the cost of moving a ton of grain from the inland facilities to the Gulf of Mexico. And we're lacking there. I mean, our infrastructure is decaying. We're not the most efficient. Other places in the world are new, and they're growing, and they're making these investments, and they're making investments in on-farm technology. So their unit cost is coming down. And our unit cost, when you add in land prices, is probably coming up. So there's going to be some real soul searching, I think, in the next few years when you try to look at how competitive we are versus some of these other regions of the world. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't continue to keep our land base fully occupied. I have every confidence that we will, but it's just how we're going to do that. What will be the crop and livestock mix for American agriculture going forward? That's why I think farm policy and some of these looks ahead are so terribly important. And we don't seem to be doing that as much as I would like. We still seem to be looking backward or protecting and defending when maybe we ought to be looking forward a bit more. I know that's a long answer, but maybe I hit on something that's useful there. Yeah.
Just to add to that, Max, you ask, can American agriculture prosper as it loses market share? Look at net farm income for the last 3 years. It's been off the chart. Real adjusted for prices, real net farm income for 2013 is expected to have been exceeded only one other time in history, and that was 1973. So American agriculture is prospering pretty well despite the decline in market share. I don't see that decline in market share as a bad thing. As you look around the world, JB pointed out that our land base is pretty fixed, and we're farming a heck of a high proportion of it right now. But if you look at UN's projections for how we're going to feed the 9 billion people and other people's projections, generally they range 70 to 90% of the increase in food will come from yield increases and not area increases. But it means 10 to 30% could come from area increases, but that's not going to be here. It's going to be in other countries. So I think it's a good thing if other countries can start to close the yield gap between our yields and their yields and sustainably farm more of their land and improve their agricultural systems. I as soon as you asked that question, it reminded me, I took a course on economic development very long time ago when I had black hair, and I remember this guy, this economist. Maybe you remember him, Walt Rostow. You ever that name? Ever ring a bell?
Yeah.
You know, and he was asked about, you know, what is economic development all about, and his answer was, the poor get richer, and the rich slow down. The poor get richer, and the rich slow down. So I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing. I'd like to see the poor get richer. So.
And I'll just add from a restaurant menu perspective, if you think about how the restaurant menu now has, in essence, become globalized, and the robust distribution and supply system which exists now has allowed consumers' palate to really become that level of sophistication and is now a basic expectation in many restaurant experiences. So when one thinks about, for example, ethnic cuisine utilization on American restaurant menus, it is a substantial area of growth and is an important driver behind the growing proportion of the food dollar spent away from home. And so when we talk to restaurant industry suppliers, the ability for them to work with restaurant operators, because restaurants are the initial point of trial for a lot of these new products and cuisines and flavors and taste sensations. And then once the restaurant patron becomes familiar or exposed, then it translates into the retail side as well. So the one important fact now for the restaurant industry compared to 20 and 30 years ago is the increased reliance on not only sourcing, but ethnic cuisines. And so, for example, if you take the top ethnic cuisines on restaurant menus, not surprisingly, it's Chinese, Italian, and Mexican. But there's second and third tier levels now that are extremely robust and growing. For example, Peruvian, Thai, that type. And so when one looks at the growth of the restaurant industry over the next decade, that component, the internationalization of traditional American restaurant menus, is an important area of growth.
We've got time for just one more quick question, and then we'll close up. We just had some excellent questions from the audience, so thank you for all of those. And Holly Spangler, you want to ask the last one?
Thank you. Holly Spangler with Farm Progress, and this won't be nearly as smooth as Max Armstrong's question. But I report from Illinois, the land of locks and dams and corn that we like to send around the world. We've talked about infrastructure some, and I just wonder, what's your outlook? You know, what's the best and worst case scenario, I guess, for our locks and dams, and how soon do you think we get to either one or the other?
Well, I think if you, being in this town, stand around a few minutes, you're going to hear about budget and sequestration and no money and the fiscal problems. So we're in one of those periods where the decisions are really, really tough. There's just not a lot of funding to do things that, whether there are more good projects than there is funding, I think. And so I think it behooves the policymakers to try to look at those investments, which will make the greatest dividend for the American people. And as I said, we've got a lot of those areas, everything from the air traffic control system to the interstate highway system and the rails and the ports and lots of other things in between, the public buildings. And you hear every day about some new infrastructure need. So there are a lot of those. I think it is, again, very important for the agricultural industry, the agricultural community, to make our case that we make a big contribution to this country, especially to the trade balance. If you look at the trade balance on a sector-by-sector basis, agriculture ranks right up there as one with a positive balance year after year. So I think it behooves us to make the case that that we have projects that are worthy of consideration and try to point out the business case that we have for those.
Anyone else care to add?
Excellent ending point.
Great. Well, it has been an incredible treat to have these three experts with us this afternoon, so please join me in thanking them. Thank you.